Welcome to the Modern Outdoor Dynamics Podcast, the official podcast of Mod Outdoors. Now, for your two hosts, Hunter Parrock and Levi Virgili.
Welcome back to episode 4 of the Modern Outdoor Dynamics Podcast. I'm Levi, and this is Hunter, and we will be introducing our special guest of this episode.
Yeah, we got Bob Holby with us from Backcountry Ridge Runners and Whitetail Properties. Bob's been a good friend of mine for a while now, and he's played quite the role in finding me the new hunting property and house that I just picked up. So, Bob, thanks for coming on with us tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys.
What's it been like working for Whitetail Properties so far? Have you liked it?
I've really enjoyed it. It is a great, great place to work, great group of guys that we work with, and there's nothing better than walking hunting properties to make some money.
Man, I tell you what, it doesn't sound like it could get much better than that. I mean, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Absolutely. This Whitetail Properties is a side job for me. I work at a shop full time, and this is kind of the fun side job. And it is definitely that.
Nice. I gotcha. And I could tell because, I mean, we've walked quite a few properties together and you know, just interacting with you. It seems like you're really bringing best of both worlds to the table here because you have quite the background in construction. And I mean, you've also been quite the outdoorsman yourself. So, I mean, it's a really great combination that you're bringing to the table for Whitetail Properties there.
Absolutely. I have a lot of time in the field. I've been hunting since I was 12 years old and probably a little longer than that. Construction-wise, I learned a lot right out of high school. My dad was a part-time contractor, so I've worked around houses, especially old houses, most of my life. That's a huge advantage when we're looking at stuff, just like on your house. When we first walked up to that, we were both like, oh, like, okay, let's take a look. And I told you walking in the door, I was pleasantly surprised.
I remember that, as was I. You know, that right off the bat looked a little bit rough, but I mean, you helped me realize that it was actually a great base, a great foundation to build on, solid bones. And, you know, we're going to run with it. I think it's going to be great.
Yep. And that is definitely what it is. It is solid bones. You can definitely do whatever you want in that place to make it look the way you want it.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Super excited for it.
Yeah, I'm happy for you guys. I'm happy it worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Bob. So kind of shifting from the real estate side of things into the outdoor side, new customer comes to you. They say, I want a hunting property. What are kind of the first characteristics that you're going to look for in a property? What are you going to connect between that customer and what they're looking for?
All right, so when a customer first comes up to me, some of my first questions are obviously going to be, you know, how much property are we looking for? What's our budget? Where's the home area going to be? And then we kind of build from there. So in your case, we were looking for 50 plus acres. You know, you wanted to be in Erie County. That was a challenge.
Yeah.
We definitely looked at a lot of properties, not in Erie County.
Yeah, branching out into, yeah, this probably isn't going to be a house, more of a camp type of property.
Yep. And then we just kind of start dissecting it from there. Like, you kind of have to get boots on the ground, start looking at places. And then as we're talking during those showings, we get a better feel every time for what we're looking for. So sometimes that phone conversation is just going to give us a short base, like, here we go. We're gonna shoot some listings at you. Something's gonna catch your eye, and then we're gonna walk it, and then we're gonna start really digging into, like, this is what I actually want.
Yep, I gotcha. You know, I mean, it's nice looking at these properties on, you know, whitetailproperties.com, checking them out on the internet, looking at the boundaries and the topo on Onyx, but I didn't really get the full benefit and the full experience of diving into these properties until you and I got out there and, like you said, put boots on the ground. And you know, I've walked a few properties with you, and I mean, it's very easy to say that you are able to look deeper into these properties than just their face value, just what you see off the bat. You can kind of dive into their potential. You can look at these properties for what they can be.
Yeah, that's one of my specialties, and that's something that I've learned to do on my own property is I had this, and what can I make it into? and just start, you know, researching, you know, watching as much YouTube videos and wherever I can gather up any information whatsoever. And how do I apply that? And I do that when I'm walking a property with any client, like, man, there's some potential here. And if there's potential, like, I am going to definitely point that out and be like, hey, like, we can sell you on this because of that. And it is going to be so worth it in the end.
So, Bob, if somebody comes up to you and they're looking for a property, mostly to hunt, and they start asking, you know, kind of food or bedding. I know that's a big question. And certain people, I know Hunter loves his bedding. What's your personal preference?
My personal preference is food. And Hunter's been on my my food plot farm, and he's seen some of the results that I'm producing over there.
It's impressive.
I look for natural screening terrain. I'm looking to have that 7-course meal over there. I want the deer to come over and want to be over on that property as much as possible. And I have that mentality, you know, give them something that they can't get anywhere else. So if your neighbors have corn and soybeans, I'm the guy planting oats and clover. There's an apple orchard across the road, I'm planting pears.
So Bob's place is where you can get all the tasty snacks that nobody else in the neighborhood has.
Oh yeah.
That's right. You want to give them something that they can't get anywhere else and something that they want.
Now, is that something that you like saw before, or did you just kind of say, if I was a deer, this is what I would do, and you just kind of tried it and it worked well for you?
So it's a combination of things. I mean, number one, just time in the field. I mean, you guys have been watching these animals for, you know, however many years, and you're like, man, this deer really likes that tree over there. I wonder what's different about that tree. And then you go over there and you find something like it's a white oak. And it's, okay, everything else around here is a red oak. You know, why is this one so special? And then you start doing some research. And then the next thing you know, hey, this one has a higher sugar content. Deer like their sweets.
Yeah, that's so very interesting.
You know, so you do that. And then, you know, you're talking to fellow hunters and stuff that, you know, they've seen research. I do tons of research on the internet. You know, what's working for other people in this area. We have a very high pressure area.
Yeah, you could say that again. Pennsylvania, yeah. Most hunters per square mile.
Yep. Yep, we have a lot of pressure in our area. So if you have a smaller property and you're trying to get deer there during hunting hours, during daylight hours, really want to give them something worth coming in for. Because if not, that pressure is going to hold them out of there.
That kind of rolls into my next question here. If I find, you know, myself looking for a hunting property and a nice property comes up, it's got great food, great bedding, you know, really nice combination of characteristics that seem really attractive, but it's right in the middle of a super high pressure hunting area. Let's just say it's surrounded by game lands or maybe a bunch of neighbors. Every neighbor hunts and hunts hard. Should that be something that, you know, would scare me off?
Pressure doesn't scare me off, especially if you have a buffer. So I'm going to screen everything that I can. I don't want those neighbors to be able to see what I'm doing. And those deer are going to know that as well. They're going to be able to go into those areas and they know that they can't be seen. They can't be pressured from the outside.
That makes sense. Make them feel safe.
Yep.
Okay. You installed some pretty significant screening at your property recently, haven't you?
I did. The road frontage, I have a lot of road frontage on my property. We ended up planting Norway spruce and white spruce. We did somewhere around 400, 450 yards worth of screening.
That's a good bit.
It is a good bit.
That's a lot.
It is. Luckily I have access to some pretty extreme, equipment. My wife's family owns a Christmas tree farm and we have a tree planter.
It doesn't get much better than that.
So I got trees for free, and then I got access to the planter for free too. I just had to put some blood, sweat, and tears into it to get it running down that flat, rocky terrain. So, but that screen has been absolutely epic.
Really? Okay.
It has really made a difference on that property.
Jump in numbers for you?
A major jump in numbers. The property before the screen, we had a couple of little food plots out there, and we would see anywhere from 5 to 10 deer. You know, people could drive by and see the whole thing. You know, from one point to the other, you could see the whole field. There's 16 acres up there. It's now an ag.
That makes sense.
And the screen is now 8 to 12 foot tall, and very, very few points where you can actually see into the field. And this past year, we were averaging between 25 and 40 deer every night.
Wow.
What kind of ratios are you seeing? Did you ever see like a increase in better ratio or anything from the food source or screening?
Obviously, with the increase of deer, we started seeing a little bit better ratio. At one point, we were seeing about 80 deer a night, and the majority of those were doe. And that kind of was a tough pill to swallow because we really thought the bucks would come in, and they really didn't. And they just weren't moving around. So we started shooting some doe and kind of thinned that down a little bit, put some more pressure on them, and that really started to get the bucks moving around.
Yeah, you think it like amplified the chase and stuff, or do you think it was a bigger, like a different viewpoint on it, maybe the food source lasting into the later part of the year to kind of bring those bucks in when the does aren't getting a chance to eat all of it?
Yes, that is something that I just recently learned, is you have your resident deer that are always going to be there, and those are the does that you want to kill. Those are the ones you want off the property. Those are the ones that are going to sit there and feed on that food 24/7, 365. So you get those does off of there. Obviously, you want deer on your property, but those are the ones that you want to nip. And that's going to make sure that there's more food there. So when you have those deer coming in off those other properties looking to be somewhere, they're going to travel on there. And that's what's going to pull bucks from other properties as well.
Yeah, so you're trying to kind of get rid of those heavy consumers and kind of extend the period that you have good forage into the later season.
Yep.
So follow-up question to that. Back when you were seeing, you know, great numbers, but, you know, a little bit of a lower ratio than what you would like, did you kind of, you know, house the mentality that if we just keep as many does as possible, the bucks will come to the does, and then kind of shift from there to, you know, if we have less does, bucks will travel more to find the does?
So, yeah, that was the mentality at first. We wanted to house as many deer as we could on the property, especially daylight hours. We were very successful at that. And we actually had a absolute stud buck come in and come up to the edge of the property, and he bedded down. He did not come into the field. There's 80 deer in the field that night. And we sat there and watched him for a couple of hours. I mean, we could see him. He was obviously out of range. And as the night wore on, we started to notice the deer in the field actually went to him. And that was kind of an eye-opening experience, kind of gave us that mentality of, we got to thin this herd down to the point that he comes after the does. And then that opened up the decoy hunting for us and some of the other things that we do on the property to really put you in the right position, you know, to harvest an animal.
That's awesome.
That is cool.
Decoy hunting is really interesting.
From guys that hunt public property, decoy hunting is a whole new game.
So when looking at some of these different properties, is there a big difference between what you would kind of seek out on a archery hunting property opposed to a rifle hunting property?
Yes. For archery, I like to have things. Obviously, the game's going to be much closer to you. So I like to have areas that you kind of have like honey holes and kill plots. So, you know, corners and edges that the deer are always going to come up and down, that you can get tree stands in, obviously be able to slide in and out of undetected, and stuff along those lines. I'm always looking for that on an archery property. Whereas on a rifle property, especially with the way a lot of people hunt today out of tree stands or shooting houses or something along those lines, I want to be able to get into an area with bedding that's not far away, and in that transition between that bedding and the food. So I want to be able to see the food. I don't necessarily need to see the bedding, but I need to see that transition area as they're coming in. And that makes a great rifle hunting spot. And obviously everything's kind of personal preference.
Sure.
In that regard, but like that works really well for my style of hunting.
Okay. I like that you mentioned about the transition areas, and that's one of actually my favorite things that I've noticed about my property. I've walked it probably two or three times now, and I've come to notice there are so many transition areas. You know, there's lots of patches, big patches of bedding, and in between each of those patches, you know, there's sections of hardwoods, there's wide open areas, there's some topography, there's a stream, you know, part of Elk Creek runs through the property. So the, you know, down in the lower portions, there's transition from bedding into swamp areas. Coming up out of the swamps, there's fields that are one day going to be food plots. So, I mean, I love the variety. Yes. I really think I'm getting a lot of bang for my buck on this property. And, you know, I'm really excited to try out all these different transition areas.
Yep. That is one thing that property has a lot of potential with, is because you have the bedding in the middle of the property and you have those transition areas, you have a water source, you have great potential for some nice food plots. Like once you get all of that out and going the way that we hope things go well with, and that's going good, it's really going to make a solid hunting property.
Oh yeah. I'm excited. I didn't tell you this. I was walking it the other day. Remember where we thought that there was that big pond? It moved.
It moved?
Beavers shifted it downstream. There is now I don't know, maybe 2 to 3 acre pond downstream of there. It's huge.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, and it's obvious that it's a big watering hole. There's some pretty beat down paths, highways leading up to it. I'm excited to set some cameras there. Might even catch some waterfowl on the cameras.
I was just say obvious potential for some wood ducks, maybe even a couple of mallards on that big of a section.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially with that I'm excited.
Dam. Yeah.
With that dam, there will be wood ducks there.
Oh yeah.
There will be beavers there too, you know.
That's all right.
Right in the beaver dam.
Yeah, they could stay.
Talking about water though, do you have a personal preference on like running water or stagnant water? I've heard a lot of guys, you know, bringing in these watering holes. They're, you know, kind of hyping up the stagnant water.
The kiddie pools.
The yeah. Kiddie pools. I look at it like this. We live in Northwest Pennsylvania. We are second to only Alaska in rivers and streams. So most of the time, deer have access to water here. I don't think that's a huge advantage, especially in Northwest PA, of putting in a watering hole. And, you know, the stagnant water, there is issues with that. There's some diseases and stuff that the deer can get from that stagnant water, where the running water seems to be that fresher, better choice. And I feel like we just have a lot of that in our area and nearby. So I don't ever really think that, you know, we get into an area and I'm like, oh my God, there's no water source. I never really feel like I run into that problem. Like there's always a creek or a stream nearby.
So I remember whenever we were looking at properties kind of anywhere in the 50 to 100 acre range there, We knew what we wanted as far as size, but what would you consider as the smallest property that would be a decent and acceptable hunting property? I'm kind of thinking, what can you look for in a property that would still be enough to attract deer and keep them there on the property?
So you're going to be a little shocked by this.
I'm ready for it.
I would say anywhere from 3 to 7 acres.
3 to 7. Single digits. Ooh.
Single digits.
That's pretty small.
And I will, and I think I told you this somewhere along the line. I will take the right 10 acres over the wrong 100 acres any day.
I remember that. Yep.
So, and I mean, that just kind of comes into line. If you can find a draw right in between two big ag fields, and it has or has the potential to have everything you need to have the deer walk through there every time they go from one field to the other, I don't need to own the ag fields.
Yeah.
I can own that small little sliver in between, and I can go in there and I can kill a big deer consistently.
What's super interesting here is you just described the property that I hunted 2 years ago to a T. It's an old vineyard. Lots of vineyards here. Yep. Along the Lake in Erie, and I'm hunting an old vineyard, and it's only 40 to 50 yards wide. Maybe 60 yards at the widest point. Just a super long, maybe 400 or 500 yard long strip. And it's, you know, the back half of it, it's pretty grown up. It used to be a vineyard a long time ago. So it's super thick. It's bedding central. And I kind of weaseled my way in there, got in on some trails, found a nice intersection and a tree that I could get up in. I scurried up that tree, and I could see both vineyards on either side. And on the back side of one vineyard, there is a little bit of ag. And truthfully, I'm not really sure what the draw is. I don't think that deer eat grapes, but they love those vineyards. I think that it just provides excellent cover. They probably graze, you know, in between all the vines.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a lot of grazing in between mm-hmm. there. Everything gets mowed. It's all nice, young, fresh grass in there. So
yeah, they loved it. Every time when I was walking out, I'd see tons of deer out there just kind of meandering in between all the different vines. And I can remember when I was hunting in this strip, I'm thinking to myself, I really hope that if I do shoot a deer, it doesn't run 30 yards that way because it would be off the property. Yep. You know, that's kind of one of the challenges that I was facing. And thankfully, whenever I had a 12 point come out, he was chasing a doe, and I was fortunate enough to double lung him at 25 yards. He went down at about the 40 yard mark on the property still.
Perfect.
If he would have went another 15 to 20 yards, he'd have been getting pretty close.
yep. Might have been knocking on some doors.
Yes, sir. But no, I mean, I guess it goes to show you can get it done on a small property. You know, that property was big, but if you're just considering the bedding, I'd put it at 5 or 6 acres.
Yep. And I mean, some of those properties that are small can seem really big because of terrain, because of stuff that's in there, that's just, they're long and narrow, or there's a ravine off of one side and you're on the far side of that ravine and you're like, oh my god, this takes forever to get into here.
You're describing your property. This is your property.
You haven't even seen the big section yet.
Oh jeez. Oh man, I remember we were turkey hunting on your property. It was, what is it, 45 acres?
About 40 acres.
40 acres? It feels like 65 acres.
Yeah.
Just the way that you have those blinds positioned, the way that the hills kind of roll, the terrain, it all adds up together, and it just feels great. It feels like a lot of land.
Yep. Having property screen itself is a huge help. Now, and you mentioned how many deer you saw in the grapes in the vineyards there. Think about that. Every strip is screened off. So you can get 20, 30 yards away, and some of those deer, I mean, they know there's deer in the area, but they can't see them. and you can just keep piling and piling and piling deer in. And I mean, that's something that happens on my property is I will have different groups of deer in different corners and they can't see each other. You know, they can smell other deer, but they just can't see what's going on until they all walk into a center point, which just so happens to have a tree stand, you know, facing it.
Very strategic. I like it.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time figuring out where to put those stands and where to put food in the right spots to draw these deer in and to move them over to where we want them.
Now, have you seen anything with doing the different sections of screening like you were talking? I've heard a lot of times where deer will only spend a short period of time in each section, and that kind of keeps them maybe 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, whereas if it was one full section, they might just kind of pass through in one 10-minute increment.
So you're talking more about bucks. Yes. Than, 'cause doe will come in and sit all day in a yes. corner. A buck will come in and inspect a field. And if it doesn't see what it wants out in that field, he will leave. Well, when you're screened, I know people have talked about, you know, don't have any more than 3 acres visible. And I can truly believe that because my property naturally screens itself. And I will watch deer walk in a big circle around my property because they're checking out every corner because there's a doe, a couple of doe in one corner. So they're going to walk over and check the other corner. And they can't see the far side, so they have to walk over to the far side to check that. And I've watched bucks actually walk around that whole property checking it. And, you know, you throw up a couple of, you know, ropes, you know, mock scrapes, stuff for them to go hit. And the next thing you know is, you know, they're walking those edges, those hard edges right by your stand to get to those spots to check that mock scrape, to check that corner where there's normally doe. You may not be necessarily hunting in that corner, but you're in their way to get to it.
So you're kind of just trying to increase the period of time that they're staying on the property by creating like interest. Absolutely. Along with food and bedding, of course, in a perfect world, but everybody talks about that.
Absolutely. And I don't necessarily work for bedding on my farm. I only have a block of woods that's about 6 acres. The rest of it is majority field. Now there's a couple of small streams that run through it, so there's terrain there. And there's trees, obviously, where the creeks are at. But they bed in there occasionally. It's not something that I would call a bedding area. But, I mean, deer will go in and spend some time in there. But my main priority is the food, holding those deer on the property in daylight hours. And then once you have the deer there and they're milling around from corner to corner, your potential of having the one that you want walk by is going to be much higher than a deer that you may know that's on a property that may only walk by your tree stand 2 or 3 times in a season. I want that deer walking by my tree stand 15, 20 times during a season. You know, that's the odds that I'm trying to get.
So regarding getting those deer to continually come around your stand, what are some really finite, you know, things that you would change, manipulations that you would make around your stands? Are you cutting down any trees, are you opening up any paths, blocking any paths, making it so it's easier for them to see, tougher for them to see?
So originally I was making small shooting lanes. That way I could see them coming and knew to get on the next lane and have a shot in those lanes. Since having kids, that has changed tremendously. We now open up fairly large paths so we can actually see the deer. It's in the lane. I can call the shot. They can take a couple of minutes to get that shot off. I always thought that was going to kind of deter the deer a little bit. But using the terrain to my advantage, it really hasn't been a big issue. So I've done a little bit of both. There's pros and cons both ways, but I do kind of like being able to see them in that big opening. That makes it a lot easier for me to self film and, you know, make sure I'm getting the shot on camera and stuff along those lines. So that has been a big advantage, and it really hasn't held the deer out of those lanes.
Nice. That's good to know. That's really good to know. So you mentioned, you know, you're getting the family out there, getting the kids out there. I take it you're getting them up in that nice big shooting house.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I'm actually finishing, putting the finishing touches on our third shooting house.
Nice. Third one. Cool.
So they're all 8x12 with a 4-foot deck. They are family stands. Anytime I can have both my girls, my wife, in the stands with me. Other times I'll have buddies, their kids up there with me, and the stands are all handicap accessible. So my father-in-law is in his mid-70s. A couple of my wife's uncles are in their 80s. They're still hunting with us, and they're able to go up in those stands. I mean, they're insulated. They can stay warm. They can talk. You know, we have the windows closed, so they're fairly soundproof, and guys can have a pretty good time up there, and the deer still walk up underneath the stands because they want to be there.
That's really good to know. That actually rolls right into my next question. I've heard quite a few takes, you know, guys trying to figure out, you know, there's deer on my property, but why aren't there big bucks on my property? And the answer that I heard to that was, well, this buck's walking around and he sees this giant floating box on the edge of a field. And he says, I don't like that. Would you say that, you know, you've kind of overcome that? You've created the ultimate buffet, and they just, you know, put a higher priority on all this food and feeling safe and secure on your property to the point where they don't really mind seeing these shooting houses anymore?
So, if you think about it, deer see all sorts of structures all the time. And whether it's on the edge of a field, whether it's, you know, a tree house in somebody's backyard that they're in there feeding on their shrubs. The big thing that keeps deer away is pressure. One of the biggest things we've implemented on my farm is you do not walk out of a stand when there are still deer in the field.
That's huge.
We will make quote unquote deer noises until those deer spook run off. I mean, I will clang my rattling horns as loud as I can and you know, snort wheeze until those deer just run out of the field. And then we can sneak out and get out of there as fast as we can, because those deer will be back out into that field in 5-10 minutes. You know, they didn't know why they had to get out, but something told them in their language that, you know, hey, let's get out of here for a few minutes and you know, clear out.
That's an interesting tactic. And I got to be honest, I think that's probably the first time I've heard that.
Really?
Yes. I've not heard that one before. I want to ask, how long have you been doing that? And have you seen, you know, reliable and repeated success doing it?
Yes, I have seen success doing it. We've been implementing this for about 3 years now. And I finally talked my father-in-law into it because he's the hard nut to crack. I mean, technically, he's the owner of the property, so I kind of have to go with some of his bad habits and just live with them. But he had a hunting season here a few years ago where he went out and he was all excited. He came back in and told me, he's like, Bob, I saw 5 bucks, 25 doe, you know, lots of deer in the fields. Like, this was just amazing. I'm going to go hunt that again tomorrow. And the next day he come back and he was like, man, he's like, that was awesome. He's like, I saw 3 bucks, about 20 doe. And he's like, I really think I'm going to get a shot. Like, they came in pretty close tonight. And, you know, the next day, the numbers just kept getting lower and lower and lower. And he hunted it for about 7 days straight. And at the end of the seventh day, he told me, he's like, man, there's no deer over there anymore. I only saw three doe. He's like, there's nothing really coming into the food plots. Like this, he's like, this is kind of a bust. And I was like, oh, okay. And I asked him, I was like, well, he doesn't see as well as he used to. So he gets down out of the stand early. And I was like, are you blowing the deer out of the field every time you get out? And he's like, well, I see white tails every time I get out. I'm like, okay. So I gave that farm, not just that spot, but I gave that farm till the last week of the season before I went back on it.
How long would you say that was? A couple weeks? 2-3 weeks?
It was about 4 weeks.
4 weeks, month? Okay. Yep.
Yep. And I was able to get in on there, and those 25 doe were back on the farm. And I was able to kill a really decent, one of my better 8 points with a bow over top of my decoy. And I was like, I saw a lot of deer. I saw multiple bucks. And I was like, the pressure had really hurt that farm for majority of the season, really, until those deer started to filter back in. And I really think a lot of that was as he was getting out of the stand early and he was blowing those fields out. And I was like, we got to change that up. So that's when we came up with this idea that, you know, we just don't get out of the stands until we clear the deer out, and we want them to clear out as natural as possible.
Yeah, I like that. I've actually heard of people blowing whistles or using like train horns on their phones or something. And that's not very natural to me, especially where Hunter and I are hunting. That's kind of an out-of-the-ordinary noise.
Yeah.
The way that you're doing it is definitely more natural, and I can definitely agree with that. I've experienced when I was younger, I blew deer out when I was climbing out of my stand. And I told my dad, he was like, that's just terrible. He was super disappointed, and I didn't understand why.
Yep.
And I was hunting there a little bit more, and I quit seeing deer. And same thing. He said, you blew them out. They know you're there. So there was another day that I hunted it. Come in the afternoon, doe comes walking by. She looks directly up right at me, exactly where she busted me a couple days prior. And I had no other explanation, but she watched me do that.
Yep. I hate when they see you come in and out of the blind. They know you're up there. That your scent's going to be there no matter what. You're going in and out of the property. They know you're on that property. Deer very sensitive to that. If they don't know exactly where you're at, that helps you tremendously. And I think I told Hunter about this at my old house. I had a tree stand in the back corner, and go up in there. Me and my wife used to go archery hunt out of there together quite a bit before we had kids. And we had this one big barren doe that at some point I must have spooked her out of that stand. And she would come out into the field. The wind would be in our favor, everything. And she would walk over at 60 yards, look into that corner, snort, stomp her feet, blow out that entire field, and run off. And it didn't matter. I watched her do that from another stand on the property. And she still walked over, stared at that corner, and blew that field out.
With the stand empty?
With the stand empty.
She blew it an empty stand? She
blew it an empty stand.
Oh my gosh.
So that's...
She's got to go.
She was an old smart doe. She did not go. I tried really hard.
Oh, jeez.
But I mean, that just goes to prove that, you know, that pressure that she got from that stand had her spooked to the point that she knew that there was danger there. And whether we were there or not, she was going to try to make sure that everybody knew to stay away from that corner.
Yeah, I've been pinned in the stand many of times. This year I hunted in Hunter's stand, actually, after he took that deer. And same thing, he's sitting there texting me. He's like, hey, man, been back at the car for about an hour. Where you at? I'm like, there's deer. I can't move. I'm pinned. And I could not get him to clear. So I had to just wait it because his dad was going to come hunt it. And that was my concern.
Yeah. Yep. Early season, I've had really good luck with the rattling antlers clearing out the area. You know, they're always fighting, and you can always call a deer in with those light rattles. But if you get aggressive with it, they just seem to not want to deal with that. So they will normally clear out.
We'll have to try that.
Yeah, I'm going to start carrying my rack a lot more. So, kind of touching here on a new question. You get a brand new property. Let's just kind of leave some of the characteristics aside, you know, regarding bedding and food. Let's just say it needs a little bit of everything. What's one of the first changes you're going to make, or one of the first things that you're going to do on your property? Are you going to do something, you know, minimally invasive, just set some trail cameras out, maybe make a mock scrape or something? Or are you going to go all in? You going to plant food plots, plant trees, move some ground, maybe big box blinds, you know, or are you going to stay on the kind of less invasive side right away?
I'm not going to put up a box blind for 3 to 5 years. I'm going to do a lot of research before I put that type of an investment in. Walking onto a new property, I'm definitely going to see what food sources are there, what there's to be offered, and, you know, kind of expand my search from there. So if I have a lot of hardwoods, I'm going to probably spend my time in those hardwoods and try to find out, like, where are the deer coming in? Where are they coming out? Set some cameras up, and then, you know, kind of go from there. If I'm in a situation where it's mostly open, like, my food plot farm that I have, I am going to plant some food. I am going to try to see what's the potential is to be drawn in there. And then go from there. So I do plant a lot of trees, apples and pears and persimmons and chestnuts. And I, like I said, I want to give them that 7-course meal.
Bob Holby buffet.
Oh, yeah. But I also want to strategically plant those things in areas that I want to kill deer. And I go off of a drop time chart. So I want the fruit dropping at the time that I'm there hunting. So if it's an early archery spot, I'm dropping in, you know, late September, early October.
This is one of my favorite things about his property. I love this part about it.
Yeah, it is. It's so cool. You know, the trees are just set up. My rifle spots are set up to drop in late November, December, early January. I even purchased some trees this year for some late season stuff that's going to drop in February, March.
That late. What's dropping that late?
It's a crab apple.
Okay.
It's a crab apple. It holds.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yep. And I mean, the pears, you know, I have those set up. A lot of those drop early archery into the rut. So, I don't know if you've ever hunted under a pear tree, but it will look like the deer come in and till underneath those things when the pears start dropping. I mean, it's pretty crazy. And they have a high sugar content, so you get a lot of bucks.
Okay. They just turn into bulldozers.
Oh, man. They tear that stuff up. They tear that stuff up.
Yeah, I like that you you plant things that are going to drop or produce in different times of the year, because that also helps to kind of minimize how intrusive you are in different areas of your property.
Yep.
That's very, very smart.
Yep. One of the things that I'm doing, it's actually going to be next year. I ordered this stuff this year, is I actually ordered some apple trees that drop in late June. Late June, early July, and I ordered some trees that drop in late July into August.
You know why I think that's going to be great? Because you're keeping those deer on your property. I mean, yeah, it's super early to keep them there for hunting season, but what is the crucial aspect that time of year? It's when they're growing their antlers.
Antler growth and fawns nursing.
That's right.
So those are two big times a year for, I mean, that's probably the biggest time of year for these animals, is when they're putting on that antler mass and when they're feeding those fawns. Like, giving them food that time of year, especially a mass crop, that you don't see that in this area very often. And I'm also training them not necessarily to just stay on the property, but to come over and check out the food sources that are available.
Yep. Like,
they're going to see those other apples that aren't quite ripe yet, you know, and trust me, they can smell that.
I got an interesting one. What's been your best experience, you know, showing properties through whitetail properties, and what's been your worst? Any horror stories?
Honestly, the best experience was probably one of the first ones I showed. Not quite knowing exactly what I was doing on the real estate end of things, but it ended up being an awesome little cabin property, and we got to walk the whole thing, and it was just one of those, it was almost like walking around a state park. I mean, the property was just so nice, and it sold itself. Like, it was just one of those perfect situations. Like, it was perfect for the client. Everything kind of went right, and I just kind of had to, like, you know, beginner's luck on that one. Yeah, I was just kind of like, yeah, this is great. Like, I had this all planned out, and like, oh, look, there's a deer, and you know, they're just feeding across the backside of the property. It was just a really, really great situation.
That's so cool. The stars just aligned, huh?
And I think for, you know, the worst situations that I've ran into, and 90% of them is going to be people. I've had people come out to look at places, and they really didn't want to be there. And it's like, okay, we drove an hour and a half to look at this place, and you know, you made your decision a half an hour before you got there that, you know, this is horrible and a waste of your time, and everything's so negative. And it could have been a diamond in the rough type deal, but they just did not want to look past the rough.
Yeah, I feel like you got to be a little bit open-minded when you're kind of looking into some different things, because, I mean, everything has a little bit of potential. Some things have a lot of potential, though. You just got to know what you're looking at.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is Pennsylvania. This is not Iowa. You know, we're not looking at world-class deer hunting and world-class accommodations. You know, we might be looking at a camp in the Allegheny Mountains that's been up for 60 years and, you know, needs some TLC and some property that's overgrown and you know, needs worked. But if that work is put into it, like, it can be a very, very nice area. And some people have a hard time looking past that.
I can attest to that. You know, if I wasn't so open-minded, I might not have the property that I now have. You know, I remember coming down to see that property that I bought, thinking to myself, well, it's a good bit of land. Land looks pretty good, but the house, we're not so sure about it. And I tell you what, once I stepped inside and took a look around, oh man, it's like someone flipped a switch.
Yep. And I remember you spent a lot of time staring at it on Onyx. And I told you, I was like, we got to walk it. Like, it looks okay on Onyx, but once you walk it, it was like, okay, this has potential.
Yep, this is it.
So over the course of all the deers and doing all this different stuff and trying to make the property exactly what you want, can you share what probably your biggest mess up was?
I've had a couple of things happen. One of probably my biggest regrets is I had a chestnut tree that was growing amazingly. I had two of them that I had bought from a local nursery. They were up probably about 15 foot tall, and I did not get the one out of the tube quick enough. I girdled it and killed it after it had been in the in the field for like 6 years, 7 years.
That is disheartening to hear, because I currently have those chestnut trees that you just picked up for me sitting outside in buckets, and I'm trying to nurse these things and keep them alive. I've already lost a couple of them.
So, it happens. I lost one the other day, one of those seedlings. I was like, eh.
And it, well, I mean, they're only a foot and a half tall. I can't imagine how you know, heartbroken you must have been losing one at 15 feet.
Yep. And the worst part about that is the one next to it was starting to produce. They would have both been producing at that height, and they didn't have any pollen because the other tree died. So at the all of the nuts that it was producing were just that there was no meat to them. They were just flat. They were not pollinated. So I ended up having to plant more trees in around them, and those are now starting to get, you know, 7-8 foot tall and starting to produce pollen. But I mean, I lost a lot of time because I didn't get that tube off fast enough. Another mistake that I made, I ordered a bunch of persimmon trees, high dollar trees from a company. And supposedly they had a guarantee. Well, when they got to me, there was a note in there saying that we will not guarantee our trees in your temperature zone.
Oh.
But my temperature zone was listed as viable for their trees. So I was like, okay. So I put out 6 of these at probably close to $70 a piece, and every single one of them died.
Wow.
They did not make the year.
Oh,
that was a little disheartening. That was a big chunk of money.
Note to self, avoid persimmons in northwestern PA.
Yes, there is a couple varieties that grow. I have a variety that's in the ground right now that is supposed to grow here, and so far it is doing awesome.
That's good. How long have you had it?
This will be 1 year.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep, so we'll see. Obviously, the winters are what gets them. So we'll see how things go next spring. And if it goes good again next spring, I'm going to probably order a couple more. I did recently start burning my food plot fields off. And it's a great idea. I absolutely love it. The first one I did, I thought I would do things to make it go faster because I didn't have a lot of time. So I did it with the wind. And that's a bad idea. I was afraid that I was going to burn the soybean field down. I killed probably about 12, 15 rows of soybeans on the far side of my food plot on the ag field. I had flames 15, 20 feet high by the time it reached the far side of the field. And I mean, it sounded like a freight train. So that was a mistake. I won't do that one again.
Fire department show up?
No, the neighbor did though. Yeah, he come flying down. He's like, "Are you okay?" He's like, "What happened?" And I was like, "I did this."
Oh, jeez, like, Bob, you didn't invite me over for s'mores.
Yeah, no. Burning weeds is not good s'mores fire either. I mean, it was crazy. I was running around with a rake. I was all by myself, which was another mistake. I do a lot of things on the farms by myself, which may not always be the brightest thing, but running around with that rake trying to put all those little fires out that were spreading where there shouldn't have been fire was one of those that I was like, huh, note to self.
That'll teach you a little something.
Yeah, don't do this again.
Now, do you think there's a higher risk factor of planting trees opposed to like a crop?
Not necessarily a higher risk factor. I mean, there's pros and cons to both. I mean, some of your trees have diseases that they can get. Crops are seasonal. So, I mean, we have a year where we have either too much rain or not enough rain. You know, those crops can not do as well. So I like having that combination of both. You know,
yeah, get a better yield kind of out of the combination.
Some of those mass crops are always going to have some apples. They're always going to have some chestnuts. They're always going to have some pears. And, you know, you can plant a field of turnips and all of a sudden we have a dry July, August, and we're going into September and they're not even the size of radishes yet.
Oh, yeah. I kind of relate it to diversifying your assets. You know, if you have a rough year for your crops, you can kind of fall back on your trees.
So that's a good way to do it. That diversity, I mean, that helps you in all sorts of different ways.
Man, I tell you what, that is a lot of very insightful information. Lots of great tools that I'm going to be equipped with going into this new property. So I really appreciate all the wisdom there. But yeah, I tell you what, thanks for coming on, Bob. It's been great having you, great talking to you. I think this is made for a pretty good episode for everyone. So we're going to probably wrap it up there. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. This is Modern Outdoor Dynamics Podcast, Mod 4, signing off.